This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 27th of May 2014 on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Grundig. Hello and welcome to Section D, the hour we devote to the world of design each week here on Monocle 24. I'm your host, Tom Morris. Coming up today, we go to Norway to discuss the role that art and design have to play in commemorating the atrocities that took place on the island of Utøya almost 3 years ago.
We are reminded every day that it has to stop there. We are getting sick.
We meet British industrial designer Terence Woodgate, who illuminates us with details on his new lighting collection.
Making this juxtaposition between something which has this incredibly high technology, an LED lamp, with something that has wonderful provenance and longevity. And that's very important for me as well.
And we find out what happens when a comic caped crusader legend gets a makeover in the hands of the Japanese.
Batman is about as American as they come, being filtered through this aesthetic of Japan, and not only Japan, Japan in the 1960s. It's hard to describe why it's so cool, but it's a great sort of blending of the two pop cultures.
That's all here on Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. First, let's begin in Norway. Public art and design can be controversial at the best of times, and never more so than when dealing with commemorating painful atrocities. The Berlin Holocaust Memorial and the Vietnam War Memorial in Washington, D.C. both faced fierce criticism when they were first unveiled, and continue to do so today. Now, a striking new memorial for the 69 mainly young people who were killed by Anders Behring Breivik on the Utøya Island near Oslo, Norway, has again brought to light the delicate balancing act between public and private grief. The question is, what part does architecture and design have in this, if any? From the island, Lars Bavanger reports.
Oslo Cathedral, just days after right-wing extremist Anders Behring Breivik's twin terror attacks on government buildings and a Labour Party youth camp in 2011.
Massakren på AUF's sommerleir på Utøya. Vi et folk I sorg.
Vi var på en platsbesök, det första platsbesöket på Utøya, och
We visited Utøya and started inside the main building, where many lost their lives.
After a design competition, Swedish artist Jonas Dahlberg's design for a national memorial was chosen out of 8 finalists.
Och skillnaden mellan den sorgen där och när vi var ute.
And I was struck by the difference between the large sorrow we felt there and the feeling when we emerged back into the nature on the island, which had already started healing the wounds after the terrible things that happened there. So my idea was to create a wound in nature which will not heal.
The proposed monument will lie where I'm standing right now, at the end of a narrow peninsula pointing out towards Utøya Island, which is less than a kilometre across the water here. The idea is to cut a 3-metre-wide channel straight through the peninsula, turning the tip of it into a separate island. The names of the dead will then be engraved on the cut rock, visible but forever unreachable from the land side. This was chosen by the Norwegian government's body for public art. Jørn Mortensen headed the jury.
The initiative came from the former government as a response to expectations amongst the national support group for the families. We've been through a long period of investigations and also research trying to sort out what kind of aesthetic response would be reasonable as a national memorial. The artwork which was chosen was done by a unanimous jury decision after we had assessed 8 different proposals, actually.
Now, to get to the memorial site, you have to drive down this narrow country road past a small community of some 400 people, all overlooking the Utøya Island. And nearly all those who live here experienced firsthand the massacre and the aftermath. Ole Morten Jensen is one of them.
All the blood, the noises, the shooting, the screaming, No, I don't want to remember that. It's cruel for a government to expect us to be reminded of that. It's not necessary. There are a lot of places where no people live, where they can put this place.
Also visiting the proposed memorial site this spring evening is Katrine Lutken. She lost her 17-year-old daughter to Anders Behring Breivik's bullets at Utøya. She and several other victims' relatives feel the national memorial is one too many. 3 years on, and she still struggles with what happened and needs no more reminders, she says.
I think about it every day, several times a day. I have difficulty sleeping at night. There's a lot of us are still struggling, and it's terrible. Even soon, 3 years later, it's terrible. I think that we have enough with our graves to our children, and we have also a memorial place in our towns, and we have Utøya. We have we are reminded every day that it has to stop there. We are getting sick.
The debate around the Utøya Memorial has highlighted the fault lines between private grief and national trauma. Breivik killed 77 people and injured hundreds on the 22nd of July 2011, leaving thousands of people directly affected by the aftermath. So how do you find a consensus when trying to choose the right artwork to commemorate such an event? Jørn Mortensen from the art jury thinks conflict is, sadly, unavoidable.
There's always different opinions about memorial proposals. That was also the case in Washington, D.C. when Maya Lin's proposal for the Vietnam Veterans Memorial was introduced. The same thing applies to the memorials in Berlin. So it is actually part of the commemoration process to balance different opinions about the memorial. The site for the most personal grief is probably on the graveyard. So the National Memorial serves a different purpose than the most private grief, I guess. But that's also taken into account when we made the decision we did.
The plan was for work to begin here on this peninsula facing Utøya already this summer, and for the memorial to be ready in time for next year's fourth anniversary of the attacks. Now that deadline has been extended with one more year to allow for more dialogue between all the parties who feel they should have a say in how Norway remembers the victims of the 22nd of July 2011. For Monocle, near Utøya, I'm Lars Bevanger.
Thank you, Lars. This is Section D with me, Tom Morris. Having designed pieces for everyone from Established & Sons, Concord Lighting and SCP during his lengthy career, Terence Woodgate is one of the UK's most respected industrial designers. Though he's known mainly for his furniture, defined by a simple minimalist aesthetic, he's dabbled with lighting in the past. However, he's recently wholeheartedly embraced the sector and has launched a collection in collaboration with LED manufacturer Megaman. Terence designed all lights in the solid range from the ground up, a collection which aims to help re-educate the still dubious public about the merits of LED. Terence came to join me in the studio of Midori House with Megaman's Fred Bass to shed some light on the solid collection.
I've been designing professional lighting for many years. I was an exclusively retained designer for Concord Lighting for a long time. Fred used to be with Concord many years ago. That's how long we've known each other. And I've always wanted to create my own products. I say always. I've been wanting to do that for quite a while. I've always been envious of people like Inga Mora. And a lot of people advise me that I shouldn't do it because I don't know anything about logistics. I don't know anything about distribution, et cetera, et cetera. But I do have a good understanding of design, and I do have a good understanding of manufacturing. And I've focused on that and rationalize the design as much as I possibly can. And now it's come about.
So tell us about the collection, the materials you've used in particular, which is quite interesting.
We decided to base it on this particular Megaman GU10 lamp. I realized it was always going to be a competitively priced lamp, and I certainly wanted it to be reasonable. I'm one of these people that feel that good design should cost less than bad design. So we rationalized the design in terms of manufacturing, and based it on materials such as marble and timber. Timber because it's a flammable material that you can put in very close proximity with an LED lamp. So that makes for some interesting, you know, design possibilities. And marble, because it's such a lovely material, has a wonderful provenance. It has a beautiful quality. I mean, it's incredibly tactile. I mean, it's a pendant light. I think you really have to sort of touch it as well. It's very beautiful in that sense.
You can use these materials, which you wouldn't be able to do with old halogen or filament bulbs. Is that right?
I think in some cases you could do it with filament bulbs, but it's a different sort of challenge because the heat is the real problem. I mean, incandescent burns at 2,500 degrees minimum, and an LED, you really got to keep the chip below 65 degrees. So it's a massive difference. And for the first time, we're designing without fire. If you go back to cave time, when we first lit our homes with burning wood embers, an incandescent lamp is a filament that's burning within a gas. It's controlled, but it's still fire. Whereas now what we've got is a semiconductor, which is emitting photons. It's more relevant to the Large Hadron Collider in CERN than anything else. It's a remarkable technology.
I mean, we were just talking earlier about this project being sort of in the running for about 2 years now. How have you seen the knowledge and the sort of the possibilities of what you can do with LED change over the past 2 years?
It's incredible pace of change. I mean, the lamp we started looking at 2 years ago is no longer in the product. It's now a much more compact, higher output, lower wattage lamp. Things change so rapidly, and the colour quality is much improved. And we're just about to launch the smart version of the lamp, which will have a Bluetooth control built into it. So Terence, I know, is very interested in having a Bluetooth-enabled product, which you'll just link to your smartphone and switch it on and off and dim it. When he doesn't have to do anything to the fixture design, it's integrated in the lamp. There's a convergence of technologies in the last couple of years with the new Bluetooth control coming in and also more sophisticated RF controls.
There's still a massive kind of misunderstanding and mistrust and dislike of LED, isn't there?
Yes, there is. There's an enormous sort of misunderstanding in the market. And it's because lighting up to LED changed so very slowly. So people saw LED in the early days and they think it's still like that. But LED is a semiconductor business, not an old lighting, traditional lighting business, which stayed constant for many years. It's changing every few months. So what you saw even a year ago is no longer the case. And you now have affordable LED solutions, good quality light, running very cool, as Terence says. And you can use them close to materials which you never could before. You can bring the light right down to even quite sensitive materials and save a lot of energy actually by bringing the light closer to the material. And I think with Terence's pendants, you can do just that. You can bring them right down to above a table to bring a nice atmosphere in a wooden housing, which you can never do before. It's very interesting. And the light quality is quite relaxed, nice ambience. In Terence's pop-up showroom he had just in the last couple of weeks, it was great, wasn't it? I think he had 96 watts in the room with about
lighting about 16 fittings.
I mean, it's just it's so little heat. It's quite incredible. And all controlled dimming functions and everything. So it worked very well.
The Bluetooth is really exciting. You know, the fact that you can buy a series of light fittings and with your smartphone, with your iPad, with a tablet or a smartphone, you'd be able to group them together and dim them is remarkable without having to rewire the house at all. So all of a sudden, this new smart devices are actually coming on stream, which is a whole new direction.
Yeah, it's only made possible by the changing technologies.
And in terms of the light itself, which I think is probably the one thing that many people are sort of still very wary of, it's not blue anymore, is it? It's not that kind
all.
Of harsh.
It's interesting. Megaman never made the halogen lamp. So in our world, in the Megaman world, we're actually replacing CFL with LED. And the irritation that people will have had with CFL with the delay to come on and maybe the light quality, you know, being a little bit odd sometimes, you don't get that with LED. You get a full spectrum now, completely full spectrum. It feels more like daylight if you have an LED on, whereas you're missing some of those colours in the spectrum with the compact fluorescent. So actually, I find it, the light quality and skin tones and what have you is much more
favourable.
More favourable. Yes, good point. Much more favourable. I mean, the old halogen lamp, of course, has a full spectrum, but it has also got all the heat and a bit of UV as well. LED is just emitting what you can see and in a full spectrum. And it's well controlled with the technology today. And there is just no sign of the old poor quality light you would have had. But when I say old in the LED world, that's three, four years ago. You know, things move so fast.
It moves incredibly quickly. Yeah. Could you just sort of, for the listeners, try and describe the actual design of the pendants?
We've used marble because it has this wonderful provenance. You know, it's a material that's been used by sculptors over the years. My work is minimal. I don't add decoration. I'm more interested in subtraction than addition. There's no decoration in my design. It's interesting to use a material like this, which has a wonderful quality. So we're actually looking at the material rather than something that's applied to it. And exactly the same with the timber. You have this wonderful grain, natural grain that you can see. We've called the collection solid because LEDs are solid state lighting and the materials are solid natural materials. So making this juxtaposition between something which has this incredibly high technology of an LED lamp with something that has wonderful provenance and longevity. And that's very important for me as well, to design a product that not only looks beautiful and works beautifully, but also lasts. That's very important.
Where do you see the industry going with LED? I mean, I know a fair bit about OLEDs and stuff.
Yeah.
Do you sort of work much in that field? Or?
OLEDs we've looked at, it's a technology waiting for an application. It's actually a very good technology for, say, the backlighting of screens. Yeah. So, you know, I have a mobile phone here with an OLED screen on it, and it's absolutely perfect for that. But for general lighting, it can't achieve a point source, so it can only do a sort of general diffuse source. So just think where diffuse sources are used today, and that's where OLED might have an application. But the cost of the panel, for a very small panel, the size of a mobile phone, is still prohibitive. And if you imagine a diffuse source in a ceiling, you know, 2 foot square, 600 by 600 millimeter, the cost of that in OLED would be absolutely fantastic price. And compare that with a regular office fitting. It's just not there at the moment. It may very well come if the volumes are there and the price drops, but it would be used in that niche application of diffused lighting rather than the general lighting where you need a point source to direct. In accent lighting needs a point source to control it, reflect around it and so on. So I don't think it'll take over, but it will find its niche eventually once the technology gets to a price that people can afford.
Because I think it is sort of trying to change the way people think about how they light things, isn't it?
Yeah.
The fact that LED for years was trying to sort of replicate.
Yeah.
You know, having one light source and it's sort of shining out with shadows, whereas actually it's, I think people are sort of slightly changing how they think about it. Or
I think you do need a good quality of light, and I think you've just hit on a point there which we can now achieve with LED. You can get point source and get nice crisp light, good accent lighting with drama. Lighting depends on actually light and shade. You need contrast, otherwise your eye doesn't appreciate what you're looking at. Just flat light is very boring. We went through a phase, 20 years ago, when we had a lot of green screens, you know, video screens, computer screens, and they used to catch glare from the ceiling lights. And we went through this phase of doing up lights in offices and creating this really diffused white light so there was no glare. But it was so awful. It was boring. You know, you had this flat light, no drama. It wasn't good for you. Today, you don't need to do that. You can create light and shade and control the light well.
Yeah.
LED is capable of doing all the things you could do before with halogens and what have you. And, you know, technology's moved on.
Terence Woodgate and Mega Man's Fred Bass in conversation with me there. You're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris. We'll be back after this short break.
For over six decades, Grundig has made people's lives better and simpler. To this day, we bring our expert knowledge of design and technology to a wide range of high-quality domestic appliances. Whether refrigerator or radio, oven or audio system, we continue to integrate our manufacturing heritage with state-of-the-art technology. Grundig synthesizes the best of yesterday with the best of tomorrow, expertly and innovatively designed for you and your home. Grundig, supreme engineering, timeless design.
You're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24. Last week saw the Product Design and Innovation Conference take place in London, where, unsurprisingly, the great and the good of the industry shared tips and got excited about new products going to market. One man in town to speak at the conference was designer and founder of New Deal Design in San Francisco, Gadi Amit. Through his practice, Gadi works at the forefront of technology and design. He told Section D producer Aled John about what products he's got in the running. Aled began by asking what comes first for Gadi, function or form?
For me, the ideal is to try to get to the core of the function. In my case, many cases, this is the technology, and understand, so to speak, what it means and what it wants to do. And there, from there, drive the form out and just cover it with just little styling, not too much.
So you think it's a problem-solving element to your design sort of philosophy?
Yeah, I think what we're trying to do, I call it architecture, and it does whatever architecture is doing, which is combining reasonable thinking with cultural creativity. We're trying to align, let's call it, align or position technology in a way that it is becoming expressive. It has some functional attributes for sure, but most importantly, it does interact with the emotional and cultural aspects of life.
How are you doing that, Gani?
We are playing a lot. And through these discussions in the studio, we come to realization of some key problems. And then when we are trying to approach these problems and solve them, we understand that there are some bigger truth, if you wish, to what the object is meant to do. And then it's actually quite easy to get to the form. I could bring an example.
Please do. So what have we got before us?
We got a mock-up of Google Aura.
Yeah, the Aura modular phone. Before we begin discussing the deeper meaning behind the function and the form of the phone, let's describe the design for us if you can. So it's modular, you can amend the spaces, you can move the parts around?
Yeah, so in essence, it's had a skeleton, an internal skeleton, hence we call it an endoskeleton. And it's made of aluminum, but then on top of it, on both sides, on the front and the back, you would have a variety of rectangular modules that could come in any color and so on, and they are interchangeable. And going back to the question you asked me before, the pivotal moment here was the discovering of a concept we call parceling that was driven from the need to bring both many manufacturers and many consumers to exchange modules and to exchange functionalities, if you wish, through these modules.
So exchanging, say, I want more of a camera, I can upgrade the camera section of the rectangle to a better camera, for instance.
Or you may have multiple cameras, if you wish.
So can we take it apart? Is it easy to do?
Yeah. So this is a mock-up, obviously, but in reality, these elements are going to be magnetized. Actually, some of them are. You see, if you look at it. So if you
tap it and it slides itself in. So that's great. I've just detached the whole screen from the panel.
In reality, this will be done by rather strong magnets. These are what you have there are weak magnets.
I was going to say because you might touch it in a specific way in your pocket and the parts will come off in your hand.
So just to give you an example how strong these magnets were. So the innovation here is called electropermanent magnets. These are magnets that are actually magnetized or demagnetized by a jolt of electricity.
Okay.
And then they keep that magnetism permanent. So we are talking about a force that is equal to 30 kilos.
And that sustains until you want to detach it?
Yeah. And then you jolt it and it becomes demagnetized and then it's free to move.
Quick question.
Yeah.
In terms of practicality, if I had my modular phone
fall
and I dropped it on the floor, what's going to happen?
Nothing.
Really?
Interesting. Well, it is so strong that nothing, let's just say, I'd say it's 30 kilos. It's actually a lot. When I tried to pry these open with both hands, I barely managed to move it. So
how do you move it then when you want to move it?
You give it a jolt.
A jolt of electricity.
Yeah, and it basically in reality you will basically go through some software and you'll detach through a very short pulse of energy and demagnetize the magnet.
Wow. I was going to say if you did drop it, unfortunately, or for whatever reason, it may be a good thing that it falls into composite parts rather than sustain all the kind of tension inside, the pressure inside from the brake.
That's a very good observation, and I think there'll be some tension between the need to keep structural rigidity of each module and actually to letting go and having this thing detached. But this could be tuned. And the other interesting thing about that, when we talked about that ability to attach and detach modules, we had this notion of what we call hot swappability, which allows you to swap batteries while you're talking.
Okay.
So, for instance, I could talk to you on the phone and the battery runs out and I'm basically swapping to a new battery.
While you're talking to me?
While the call is still on.
How does that work?
That works because the actual endoskeleton itself has a tiny battery that is good for about 5 to 10 minutes. So that allows us to swap components while you're doing something. For instance, you can swap from one camera to another and so on. So there are a lot of very interesting possibilities. And the interesting thing about Aura is that all these possibilities were kept alive by a brilliant team at Google, led by Paul Aramenko, that really wanted to keep all the cool stuff in. Mm-hmm. And that pressure to deliver on this cool stuff actually created creative necessity that drove that design.
It's a very interesting point, because the necessity to then have multiple parts to your phone, not just the multiple parts that are on the phone at any one time, but also like a backlog of other parts, which you think, well, I've got another camera which I could use, or some more batteries. Do you see that the customer often sort of accused, I guess, of slimming down on all the parts of electronics? It's a lot easier to have a phone, which is now also a camera, rather than having a phone and a camera. Do you see that they are going to be interested in a product which actually provides the opportunity to have any multiple more of composite parts?
I'm absolutely sure they will. I know many people are quite frustrated by the mobile phones now, because
certainly the battery life is
the battery life, and also people crack their screen and want to replace it, and they also pay premium for a lot of features that they're not necessarily needing. So the ability to open up to multiple cameras will allow you, for instance, to use or borrow a camera from a friend, or to opt for an old camera for a significant price reduction.
You're speaking at the Product Design and Innovation PD&I conference. It's another example of sort of cluster of design flag waivers around the world. And obviously our show focuses on that. And it's great, because design is a buzzword internationally now. Yeah. So much so that sometimes you become inured to it. You think, oh, it's another design thing. But tell us about what you're going to be speaking to at PD&I.
So I'm going to talk about another buzzword, wearables.
Wearable tech, okay.
Yeah, wearable tech is a big buzzword, and unfortunately it's misunderstood to some degree. For instance, carrying an iPhone in my pocket doesn't make the iPhone wearable. At the same time, a watch is not necessarily wearable, or a headset is not necessarily a wearable. What makes a wearable is a very unique set of technologies and parameters. First, most of these have some unique sensor that is related to your body. Second, these little gadgets are actually talking to the cloud, talking to your phone all the time, and providing you with some kind of information. And thirdly, because they're directly related to the body, there's an issue of fit, physical fit. And with that physical fit come a whole slew of social and emotional issues. So I'm going to talk about how to design these wearables and how to balance what the tech industry is really good at, I'd say intelligence or IQ, with things that the tech industry is not that good at, emotional qualities. For instance, Google tried to bring Google Glass to the market, and they are definitely having some difficulties because of that tension between IQ and EQ.
And also aesthetic.
Yeah, well, the aesthetic is part of the emotional issue. I think we are wired, and now we know scientifically, we are wired to scan the eyes. So if you're approaching any person, the first thing you try to lock eyes with that person to know whether it's a friend or a foe. And with that comes a paradigm that obscuring the eye contact is a rather difficult social or kind of an awkward position to be. And this is one example. There are a variety of examples like that. And for us, the biggest problem or dilemma in this industry is how to manage interface correctly. There is a lot of push towards providing people with more and more data, as if these wearables will just spew numbers at you and will make you happy. But in reality, it's not happening. So how to sift, how to filter, how to contextualize that data is actually the biggest problem for design there.
Gadi Amit of the San Francisco practice, New Deal Design, speaking to Aled John there. This is Section D with me, Tom Morris. Co Curzon Cinemas have been screening art house and pop culture films since the 1930s and plan to raise the curtain on three new cinemas in London over the coming year. The cinema brand has enlisted the talent of designer Aphrodite Kassa for their newest venture, the Curzon Victoria. While hopping between a Lenny Abramson film and the latest John Turturro movie at the opening night, our reporter Sarah Fournier caught up with Aphrodite Kassa to understand how her designs make this particular Curzon cinema different.
We're out outside looking in. It's a contemporary building using extensive amounts of glass. It's very transparent. It's got beautiful scale to it. Curzon's presence in terms of the facade is quite small. It's a limited amount of space they had to use. And we thought, what can we do to really bring it out and create almost like an installation piece that people stop and look at? So we looked at classic cinematic icons such as curtains. And we also looked at the marquee, which is the classic cinema icon externally. You see a marquee and you immediately think cinemas. But we thought, rather than use them as they've always been used, i.e. recreate them, how can you use new technology to create something new? So we created a digital marquee, which is effectively all constructed out of digital flat screens. And what it does, it shows you a static image of an analog marquee, which is very kind of old fashioned. But at the same time, when you're kind of looking at it, it turns into a dynamic film type of content, which might be promoting different things. It might be talking about opening hours, new films coming up. So it becomes a completely new way of using a marquee. So rather than the very static, old-fashioned way of doing, we're referring to the past by using the new technology. We took a lot of our design inspiration from the beginning of the Curzon brand, which was back in the 1930s. The typeface itself of the logotype is Futura, which is a 1929 font. And we looked at the very early days of modernism, people like Eileen Gray, people like Gio Ponti in Italy, all these very early pioneers, architects and designers who were at the time innovating, using new materials, using very bold design, very innovative kind of thinking at the time. So we took that as an inspiration. And we didn't want to create a pastiche of the past or a vintage nostalgic version of a cinema, but we wanted to be inspired by those principles, but at the same time, take that into a very contemporary context in terms of technology, projection, technology moving on, cinematic technology, audiovisual technology moving on. And we wanted to create on the facade specifically a very strong installation feature that says clearly to consumers who are passing by, this is a cinema, but it's a new type of cinema. The amazing thing is, Curzon, when they approached us, they said, we don't want a ticket box, it will be ticketless. So it was already a very innovative brief. The other thing we wanted to do is soften up the space by using this fabric sheer curtains, but rather than them blocking the inside, we wanted them to be again animated and alive, so they are projected upon. It becomes almost like a massive cinema screen itself, the facade. I quite like the idea that you go through the cinema screen in order to get to a cinema. Let's walk through the cinema screen. Thank you very much. So now we enter the ground floor lobby. This is a fairly complex space and one of the most complex spaces architecturally we've ever worked within, because the whole space is divided into four different floors, all fairly small, with a very complex type of structure that we had to work around in terms of structural columns, and a quite complex design of a staircase that would connect all these different floors. We decided right from the beginning to give each floor a specific purpose, so rather than becoming the same design and the same purpose throughout four floors repeated, we thought it's important that we give each space its own identity. I think design enhances any experience, to be honest. If I didn't believe that, I wouldn't be doing the job I'm doing. I think, you know, you go to a cinema, it should be a glimpse of delight in your life. You go to a bar, we design hotels. These are places where people take a break from the mundanity of everyday life and want to enter these magical worlds which transfer them to somewhere else. And you know, at the height of this experience is definitely the cinematic experience. It's all about magic, it's all about darkness, mystery, you know, discovery. I don't think there's a better world to express that.
Aphrodite Kassa giving Section D a tour of the new Curzon Victoria Cinema. No way to pop by central London's Lincoln Inn Fields, famed for its barrister quarters and well-preserved period housing. You'll find something of an anomaly amongst the traditional architecture. For one of these buildings has been taken over by the House of Peroni, a celebration of Italian style, design and culture, under the banner of Peroni Nastro Azzurro. Founder of the Shiro Studio practice, architect Andrea Morganti, was tasked with designing the space inside the building. He told Section D producer Ale John what one can find should they pop down.
My involvement grew in the last 12 months when I was initially invited to contribute to the first House of Peroni last July. I contributed with some pieces of artwork in a pretty much beautiful but rather empty house. So it was interesting because I was the only architect involved alongside fashion designers, more sort of smaller scale product designer like Forma Fantasma. And I was the only architect, and I thought to convey my architectural efforts in a model, in an architectural model. And I think the client reacted to that. And we also learned from the first house that it wasn't so successful, the formula of showing isolated artworks in a sort of naked, bare house, and, you know, with a bar somewhere. So together with the clients, and that's where my involvement grew, we started towards working on a formula of a more of immersive experience where the bars, the artwork, the invited artists, and my own very work would be more organic, more blending with the internal skin of the building. So this is how we arrived to this very latest house in Lincoln's Inn Fields, where is a sort of celebration of the third dimension, not just a house and artworks, but an immersive experience for visitors.
Lots of things we can get into within that answer. Let's look at, to begin with at least, the role of you as an architect in that space. Then do you see your role to have become more than just the design of the space? Then are you facilitating the narrative of the art as well, or are you crossing the line from the architectural curator from the space to someone who's involved in the art and the design of the bits and bobs that people can enjoy when they go there?
Well, I do a few things. The most urgent task I feel on my shoulders is really to establish a dialogue between the house, because it is an important event. The fact that we take over a house for a whole month, which is used for anything else, this last one was completely almost abandoned. So my aim, my challenge is to convert this house from an empty shell to something that physically engages with the visitor, and that's through the medium of architecture, whether it's temporary, whether it's 2D, 3D. So that's my first role. Second role is to facilitate the invitation of other artists, of other creative Italian talents to the house to contribute in different forms. Because again, we believe that there is a value to the biodiversity of the artworks. So not just my take on architecture, which is again, taking care of the house as a building, but make sure that the arts of fashion, of filmography, of product design are also covered. So, and in this case, I'm one of, they call me creative director, experience director, you know, whatever you want to call it. But it's my sort of advice on who to invite, who could be next, who's, you know, an interesting young talent, creative to be part of the house.
Well, there's a purity to your work specifically, but the Italian, I guess, brand Italia. How did you marry that with the very English surroundings of Lincoln's Inn Fields?
Well, you don't. You don't, because you can't, because it's so unique that the only thing you can do is not to blend and really insert a dash of color. Blue is accidentally even one of my favorite colors. I thought, what an amazing thing to really take advantage of what is quintessentially British, of breaking the rules in a creative way. In a square that is very quiet, very peaceful, and we just insert this temporary pavilion, which also London has a very long-standing history, you know, like the Disturbing Time Pavilion and DAA Pavilion just around the corner. So the pavilion was apt, and it helped us to really break the mold and communicate from the very outside, from even people walking by, that there is something unique happening in this house for a month, and that's how the pavilion was created.
And the theme, at least not the theme, but it's a nod to 1963. Perhaps you can go into not just the reasons why, but also how that influenced or shaped your take on the space.
It did. Obviously, the brand was very focused on communicating this part of their own heritage. For me, it was more digging into the folds of Italian history, culture-wise and design-wise, which was quite interesting. So, for instance, one of the, I think, most successful rooms conveying this heritage, the 1963, is the black and white room on the fashion floor, which is my room where I designed the bar. And the room is actually a sentimental homage to Franco Grignani's. And Franco Grignani was that amazing graphic designer that, amongst amazing body of work he produced, there was also the Woolmark logo. And the important is that he only used black and white sort of two-dimensional drawings, recreating optical illusions becoming 3D. So I started from that. I added a more contemporary interpretation by modeling everything 3D, digitally 3D with the computer and with 3D software. And I recreated a 2D pattern that completely wraps up the walls, the floor and the ceiling and the bar. And it creates, you know, a more three-dimensional immersive experience. And judging by people's reactions, I have to say that was quite successful. And it's the right link to Grignani's work, 1960s, 1963, and, you know, a certain finesse of operating in the design and graphic field.
I'm interested in the relationship you, as the experienced director or creative director, the title that you've been given, have with the brand. Do they give you a blank slate to work in a space like that? Is it an easy process working with a brand such as Peroni, where they have various ideas of what they want some things to look like, or was it actually very harmonious?
My work, it's mainly architecture and product design, which means you're always going to confront yourself, your pure ideas. You know, you can see you read my sort of mission in the website. And it's always a compromise. There's no such a pure thing unless you go into arts, where you don't have any clients, you don't have any brief, you express yourself in the most purest way and form. So I'm doing architecture, do product design. I welcome briefs because it's a challenge. And I have to say I've been lucky to and learned the hard way with amazing other clients like Ferrari. And Peroni is very much Ferrari. You know, they are an amazing brand, very established, with a very specific, unique visual identity. And you have to accept that and produce the most amazing sort of body of work that respects their own identity, but also allows me to convey my own sort of sense of purity and respect for materials and, as I like, a sort of tactile feel for installations and objects and architecture.
Are you happy with the result?
Very much so, yeah. I'm happy because after we complete the House of Peroni, I always hang around, you know, a few days after the opening, so I don't just show up at the opening. I come back in sort of plain clothes. And I enjoy and I learn from observing the way people react, the way people interact. I see where things are very successful and I see things that are not that successful. And everything gets metabolized and recycled in a better way for the next installation. So that's the only way to see if something works. And by the reaction I witnessed, I'm quite happy with this house, yes.
Andrea Morganti of Shiro Studio and designer behind this year's House of Peroni in Lincoln's Inn, speaking to Aled John there. You're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris.
Grundig's goal is to bring the best of the world's entertainment into your home. Its digital and DAB Plus radios allow you to access an unlimited choice of broadcasters from around the world and to listen to them with the most superior sound quality. Its new Bluetooth-enabled audio products let you play music from your smartphone. Grundig is committed to making sound crystal clear, whether it's beaming in from the other side of the world or from a mobile right next to you. Grundig. Supreme engineering, timeless design.
You're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. Now, let's end the show with a rather special birthday. Batman has been fighting the bad guys of Gotham City for 75 years. However, there's one chapter of the Caped Crusaders story that until recently remained untold. Between 1966 and 1967, DC Comics licensed the Batman character to comic book artists in Japan, the first time before or since that illustrators in another territory could create their own versions of an American comic book character. The result was Batmanga, a short-lived but nonetheless very intriguing melding of American pop culture aesthetics with manga, at a time when Japan was still rebuilding itself following the end of the Second World War. Monocle's Thomas Lewis met with Chip Kidd, the man who claims to have discovered the Japanese interpretations.
This really
obscure phenomenon that happened in Japan in 1966 to 1967, in which the Japanese wrote and drew their own Batman stories. And it was not bootleg. It was legal and commissioned. They were the only country in the world to do that. Everybody else just translated the American stuff, but the Japanese created their own.
Chip Kidd is an illustrator based in New York City who has been a Batman fan for years. The discovery, he says, made the scales fall from his eyes.
As a Batman fan, to me, it was like finding a great Beatles record that had been recorded on tour in Japan and then kind of like shelved and then never released.
Get them, boys! Get them, or it's curtains!
It started by finding out that this even existed, which I did in the late 90s. So once we had enough collected, I took a meeting with the president of DC Comics at the time. That was the easy part. He looked at it and he was stunned. He didn't know it existed. Nobody there at the company knew it existed, and it wasn't in their archive. So he said, you know, this is amazing. We need to look into this legally to make sure that we still have the rights to it, which they did. And we can work out a licensing deal. But other than that, you're on your own. You've got to find all this yourself.
And find it all himself, he did. Between 1966 and 1967, Japan produced its own series of Batman stories that saw Batman and Robin fighting crime in Tokyo. The artist behind the drawings was Kuwata Jiro, who is 79 years old. Like many Japanese comic artists in the 1960s, Kuwata Jiro began young. By the age of 14, he was already drawing comics professionally. But he remained elusive. After following a broken and sprawling paper trail, Chip Kidd says, he found him.
And basically, he apologized to me, not to me, but he was sorry that he, quote, couldn't learn how to draw like an American. He just did it the way he knew how. And it's what, to me, is part of what makes it so beautiful.
And what he found was the iconic superhero rendered in manga, a style that was, by the 1960s, figuring out its own visual vocabulary.
One of the things that characterizes manga is a sense of speed. And this is created through what literally are called speed lines. I mean, now it's common. You see it in design all the time. The Japanese really created that in the early to mid 50s, where, you know, the action is sort of visually enhanced. It's as if you can see the air moving past them, and it's moving very, very fast.
Japan's Batman was different from its American forebear, more squat, square-bodied, with a naivety, perhaps, that the American character exuded little of. The depiction of movement, too, the short, sharp dashes of movement lines around the characters made this Batman a firm part of the manga canon. And it's this that gave Batman his own visual identity in Japan.
What's so interesting about it is you have this American icon, Batman is about as American as they come, being filtered through this aesthetic of Japan, and not only Japan, Japan in the 1960s. It's just really, it's hard to describe why it's so cool, but it's a great sort of blending of the two pop cultures.
Batman's adventures in Japan may be a short-lived detour for one of the most famous crime fighters in comic book history. But for Chip Kidd, who spent a decade bringing Bat manga back to life, it's a footnote that deserves its own chapter in the comic hero's 75 years of fighting crime.
It's beautiful stuff. And it's also kind of the joy of seeing something that you're so used to in English, in another language, that then you recontextualize it in your head. And it helps you to enjoy it formally more.
For Monocle, I'm Thomas Lewis.
Thank you very much, Thomas. And to hear more about the Batmanga story, tune into next week's Culture with Rob Bound, which is all about comics. That's all for this week's Section D. Today's show is produced by Aled John and edited by Holly Fisher. You can contact the producer Aled at awj@monocle.com if you feel the need. I'm Tom Morris. And to play you out on the subject of Batman, here's U2 with Hold Me, Thrill Me, Kiss Me, Kill Me from the Batman Forever soundtrack. Thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye.